Let me begin by thanking the organizers for inviting me here to give this talk. And let me also begin by thanking my collaborators on the work which I'll tell you about. So on the theoretical side, this is Subir, my PhD advisor at Harvard, and Richard Davison, I'm one of the postdocs. And then the experimental group of Philip Kim and Casey Fong, who gave a talk in much more detail on an experiment which I'll mention briefly. And of course, much of the work on that experiment was done by Jesse. Okay, so I thought I would begin really simple and just clarify exactly what I mean when I say transport for people who may not be familiar. Okay. So transport is just a fancy word for Ohm's law, okay? It's a very easy experiment to do. I mean, it's a little more than that, but not much. So you run, an electric current through a slab of metal, and you measure the voltage drop across the metal.
How many times have you done that?
What? How many times have I done it? I did it in like an undergrad lab, probably. Okay. I'm pretty sure I did. My lab mate might have done it, actually. But anyway, apparently this is the simplest experiment. And what you find is that if the current is small, in the linear response regime, you recover that V equals IR. We don't want to compute the electrical resistance R, but we want to compute the electrical conductivity, which is 1 over R up to some geometric factors, which remove the dependence of R on, say, the shape of the device, and just give you some number which depends only on the material that you're studying. Okay. And more generally in this talk, I want to emphasize that we should be thinking about not just electrical transport, but thermoelectric transport. So we can apply electric fields and or temperature gradients across our metal, and we can measure charge and or heat currents flowing through the metal. And these will be linearly related when the fields are small by a matrix of coefficients, and this is what I'll call the thermoelectric conductivity matrix. And this matrix has to obey some nice properties. It has to be positive definite and something called Onsager reciprocal, which when B equals 0 means symmetric. But this is the object that we want to compute, okay? So let me begin in the case of Fermi liquids. So these will be most ordinary metals, okay? And so for a typical Fermi liquid, like iron or copper, okay, you've got a big Fermi sea of electrons, and the interior of the sea is just completely filled up. And when you're at any reasonable temperature, only a very thin shell of electrons very close to the Fermi surface will be thermally excited. Okay. And as a consequence of that, many properties of the Fermi liquid will not depend on which material you're looking at, what shape Fermi surface you have. They'll just be determined by the fact that this shell of electrons is very thin. Okay. So one of the first things about this Fermi liquid that's important is that you have very long-lived quasiparticles, okay? And this is because, just kinematically, it's very hard to scatter an electron here to an electron anywhere else on the Fermi surface. Just by phase space, phase space arguments, you can argue that the quasiparticle scattering time will scale like mu over t squared. And I put up this number of 10 to the minus 11 seconds, give or take, orders of magnitude here, but I think that's a reasonable number for many simple metals. Okay. So if we had a perfectly clean metal, every 10 to the minus 11 seconds, one of our quasiparticles would scatter off of another one. And we should compare this to the time it would take for a quasiparticle to scatter off of an impurity or a phonon. And one common way that we estimate that number is just by measuring the electrical conductivity and using the Drude formula. And you often find a number that's closer to about 10 to the minus 14 seconds for this scattering time. Okay. So there's a big order of magnitude mismatch between these two timescales. And as a consequence, for most ordinary metals, we can think of transport as being governed by a gas of non-interacting particles that don't interact with each other, but just bounce off of some dirty background, okay, like a pinball in some pinball machine. Now, one of the consequences of that pinball-like picture is called the Wiedemann-Franz law. And what it states is that if we measure the following thermal conductivity, which, thank you to experimentalists, I apologize, is a different thermal conductivity than the one I previously defined. But this one is defined as the ratio of the heat current divided by the temperature gradient in the absence of an electric current. And as far as I can tell, that's purely a historical choice. But in any case, this one is commonly measured. And if you look at the ratio kappa over sigma t, you find that it's usually just a number. Okay. In fact, Fermi liquid theory tells you that it has to be a number if the temperature is very small compared to the chemical potential. And this assumption that quasiparticle scattering is weak is true. And you can experimentally test this, and Casey showed this picture. And indeed, it really works for ordinary metals. Okay. So we really think Fermi liquid theory, you know, is the correct description of transport for most systems. And so what I want to think about in this talk are systems where the Fermi, where the Wiedemann-Franz law and more generally Fermi liquid theory will fail. Okay. And to ask, what are the transport properties of those systems? And so one such material where you might think that there's a good chance of seeing that kind of physics is in graphene. Okay. So in graphene, we have a honeycomb lattice of carbon atoms in two spatial dimensions. And you can analytically compute the band structure of graphene. And what you find is that there's a very special chemical potential noted by this hexagon here, where the Fermi surface exactly vanishes. Okay. And it's right at the tip of this cone-like thing. And this might remind you of relativistic Dirac fermions in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And so we'll call these Dirac cones. And so after you do a little bit of a transformation, which I don't care about, you end up with this effective Hamiltonian at the band structure level. Okay. But the speed of light is replaced by a Fermi velocity, which is about C over 300. Okay. So now what we want to do is ask, well, what would the phase diagram of graphene be if we allow ourselves to change the charge density or the chemical potential as well as the temperature? Okay. So we're going to take these Dirac fermions, and because this is a real system, we're going to allow them to interact with essentially instantaneous long-range Coulomb interactions. Okay. Now, if the chemical potential is here, say, and we're at very low temperature, then we have a finite size Fermi surface. And a Fermi liquid in 2 plus 1 dimensions is very stable against those kinds of interactions. They're strictly irrelevant, and so we'll have a good Fermi liquid down here. And similarly, we have a Fermi liquid if the chemical potential is raised to the opposite side of the Dirac point. The only difference is whether the carriers are electron-like or hole-like. But if we sit right at the Dirac point, then the usual argument for the stability of the Fermi liquid fails because there's no finite charge density to screen excitations. And so you have to be a little bit more careful and go to higher orders to check the stability of the free fixed point. And what you find is that the free fixed point is this effective interaction alpha is marginally irrelevant. Okay. And so the free fixed point is stable. And you might think that, unfortunately, that will kill any sort of interesting, strongly interacting physics. However, there are two things that work to our advantage. Firstly, because it's marginally irrelevant, the effective coupling constant as a function of temperature decays logarithmically with temperature. And when we have our log of something over t, that something is the scale at which this relativistic picture breaks down. That's set by the band structure in graphene, and it's about 10 to the 5 Kelvin. And so, this logarithm is not a particularly dramatic factor, even when you plug in room temperature. And the more important thing is that unlike in QED4, where the bare coupling constant is E squared over H bar C, which is a very small number, 1 over 137, here the bare coupling constant is E squared over H bar VF, which is 300 over 137. Now, okay, now I put 1/2 here because there's some fudge factors that you may wish to put here, depending on substrates, et cetera. But you know, regardless of what this precise number is, it's certainly way, way bigger than 1 over 100. Okay. And so even if the effective coupling constant is 1/4 or 1/3, there's still reasons to believe that any sort of weakly coupled kinetic description of this thermal plasma of electrons and holes does not behave nicely. So the expansion would fail at low orders. And so there's reason to believe that we should really think of this Dirac fluid as something very different from a Fermi liquid. It should be reasonably strongly interacting at room temperature. And in particular, maybe there's a chance of seeing hydrodynamics in very clean samples. Now, Casey talked about the challenges of actually realizing the Dirac fluid in experiments, chiefly that in real experiments, there are density fluctuations from point to point set by impurities, usually in the substrates on which you mount graphene. And so it actually took a very long time. These ideas are almost 10 years old now, but it took a very long time to actually see this green region of the phase diagram. And so as Casey discussed, the way that we observed this is by looking at the Wiedemann-Franz law. Okay. So let's begin by thinking about this region of the phase diagram, often the wings. So here we're at very high density. We have a huge Fermi surface. And whether or not the density varies from high to a little bit less high from point to point, it's still a Fermi liquid. And we recover the Wiedemann-Franz law to pretty good accuracy. Okay. Now, if you're at very low temperatures, you sort of have a bunch of Fermi liquids stitched together. The sign of the Fermi liquid might switch from point to point, from electron-like to hole-like. But you still have a bunch of Fermi liquids. And so it's not unreasonable that you would see the Wiedemann-Franz law there, too. And that's what we find experimentally. Up here, this is don't trust the measurement because electron-phonon coupling kicks in. And so there's really a sweet spot of around 60 Kelvin where we can really image the Dirac fluid, at least through the thermal conductivity. And we see that this ratio kappa over sigma t, the Lorentz ratio L, jumps up from its Fermi liquid value by a factor of 20. So the first part of this talk will be to describe to you what kinds of theories we have used to understand this effect semi-quantitatively. Okay, so the key point which I'm going to, or the key theory which I'm going to use is hydrodynamics. Okay, so let me briefly review how I would think of hydrodynamics. Sorry, was there a question? Okay, so let me begin by briefly mentioning what I would how I would think of hydrodynamics for this purpose. So imagine that you have a bunch of boxes of fluid of some large size C. Okay. And I mean large compared to some typical scattering length, mean free path, if you will, within each box. And what I'm going to imagine doing is now releasing the barriers between each of these boxes and asking, how does the system relax to global thermal equilibrium? Okay. And hydrodynamics will be the effective description of that as a perturbative expansion in the ratio LEE over C. Now, I always find it fascinating because this is the parametric opposite expansion that we're usually doing in quantum field theory. So when we do ordinary Feynman diagrams, right, we're perturbing in some interaction strength. And so there you don't want a lot of collisions, because if you had a lot of collisions, you'd have to sum a series of Feynman diagrams to infinite order. So we actually know how to get from ordinary weakly coupled kinetic theory to hydrodynamics. And that amounts to inverting a perturbative expansion, essentially, resumming a perturbative expansion to all orders. But still, I think it's worth emphasizing that we're really interested in a completely different regime to usual quantum field theory. Okay, so what do we think the dynamics will look like of this system as it's almost but not quite in thermal equilibrium? Well, you could imagine that, you know, this is some complicated sort of quantum billiard ball soup, if you will. And, you know, whatever precise initial conditions I set, this is some chaotic system. And it's hard to imagine what sort of thing I could do to this system that wouldn't get completely washed out on long time scales. No. But then when you think about it, there is one thing you could do that you would be able to keep track of on long time scales, which would be if you changed, say, the number of billiard balls in your system, or if you will, you changed the charge density that you started with. And that's because the charge density is a conserved quantity. And so if you start with charge density n plus delta n at time t equals 0, you'll end with density n plus delta n at a later time. So that's a perturbation you can keep track of. And so it makes sense that the long time dynamics in some strongly interacting system would be governed only by the long-lived degrees of freedom, the conserved quantities. Okay. And so hydrodynamics will essentially be a theory of how those long-lived quantities rearrange themselves to equilibrium over these very long scales. And that tells us that the classical equations of motion will just be conservation laws for those conserved quantities. And so we'll be thinking about systems with conserved charge, energy, and momentum. And because we're thinking about this Dirac fluid, I've written them in relativistic notation here. Okay. Now let me just briefly mention how you do hydrodynamics. So that these equations of motion are grossly underdetermined as I've written them right now. I have to tell you what J mu and T mu nu are in terms of a smaller set of variables so that these equations are well posed. And so what I'm going to do is imagine writing down an expansion of T mu nu and J mu in terms of my perturbative parameter, which is really LEE times a derivative. And the free variables will be the local densities of the conserved quantities, charge, energy, and momentum. Although it's common to swap those for a different set of variables, that's the essential physics involved. Now, at the end of the day, I don't want to sort of derive this in too much detail, but I want to emphasize to you that all the quantum physics in this problem, so all the strongly interacting physics of this Dirac fluid that we really have no idea how to compute, has all been reduced to the computation of some classical functions. So thermodynamic things like what's the pressure of the Dirac fluid at this density and this temperature, or what's the viscosity of the Dirac fluid at this temperature. That's it. So even if you can't compute those reliably, you can still say quite a lot about the resulting dynamics because you can just do two experiments, measure the viscosity, say, from experiment one, and then predict something non-trivial for experiment two. Now, you know, in practice, that's very difficult with these electron fluids, but the point of this effective field theory is that even if you can't get all of these coefficients from first principles, it's still a very powerful framework for thinking about questions like transport. I should also point out that for classical liquids like water, we're still not very good at computing all of these coefficients. But we still, you know, build boats that don't sink and whatnot. So the second point that I want to make for the condensed matter people here is that this fluid is not the same as the relativistic fluids that you would typically read about in, say, astrophysics. In astrophysics, you would have, say, a fluid of electrons and a fluid of ions in the interstellar plasma. But it doesn't make sense to think about an electron which spontaneously converts itself into an ion and an electron. Right. So you get basically more conservation laws than you have here because there's a local conservation law for both the ions and the electrons. In the Dirac fluid, it actually does make sense to think about an electron which becomes two electrons and a hole. Okay. So we're only going to have one conservation law. It's a conservation law for electromagnetic charge. And importantly, it will make sense for the electric charge to locally vary from positive to negative, from point to point. Okay. So that's very weird from the Galilean perspective. How could you have a negative mass density? But since here we're just thinking about charge, not mass, this is perfectly sensible. Okay. So now let's try to use those ideas and say something meaningful about transport. And so the first meaningful thing which we can do is to think about the conductivity of a clean metal. Okay. So Luca already sort of sketched this argument, but maybe I'll just give it again. So imagine that I start off at rest next to a charged metal that's, you know, completely translation invariant. So there's a continuous translation symmetry under which the Hamiltonian is invariant. It commutes with the momentum operator, if you like. So, you know, here's me in my new car now that I moved to California, so it's necessary. And here's me driving in my new car to work. And, you know, as I drive past this metal, now I see a charge current in this metal, okay? Because it's at some finite density, and, you know, relative to me, it's moving at some velocity v. Now, this is a bit weird because there's no background electromagnetic fields for anything I told you to be, you know. I certainly don't need to turn on any electric field for that to make sense. And so if I now use Ohm's law to compute sigma, I get sigma equals J over E is infinite. Okay. Now, in the real world, we don't measure this infinite conductivity. And the reason that we don't measure this infinite conductivity is that real metals are not translation invariant. Okay. So real metals have a lattice. There are phonons, Umkopf processes, impurities, and all of these things we have to take into account, at least in principle, to exactly compute the conductivity. So it's a bit of a mess, especially when you're working at finite temperature and density. So one thing that you could imagine doing, which is what I'll call a mean field model, is to say, okay, we don't really know how to compute, you know, all this complicated crap. But one thing we can do is to say, well, you know, if we didn't have any momentum relaxation, we'd have this exact equation, divergence of the, you know, T mu I, essentially divergence of the momentum flux, equals the charge density times the electric field. So I'm working here in, near the fluid rest frame. And so what I'm now going to do is just add by hand a term which relaxes momentum. Okay. I don't know what tau is, but I'm just going to put it in and hope for the best. So now I use so-called constitutive relations for this fluid. I'm going to say that there's a fluid velocity which is equal to the enthalpy time, or a momentum density equal to the enthalpy times the fluid velocity, and the charge current, which is the charge density times the velocity, plus this sigma q piece, which I'll explain shortly. And you put all of this in, and you Fourier transform and look at the AC conductivity. And after a couple lines of algebra, you get this simple formula. So let me begin by looking at the charge neutral case. So n equals 0, and the second term drops out. Then I get that sigma is just a number, sigma q, which is finite. Now, the logic here is that I've got this charge neutral plasma. I've got electrons and holes floating around together. When I apply an electric field, I can imagine a process where an electron and a hole moving in opposite directions under the electric field collide, lose all of their momentum, and just stop moving. But you know, the net momentum of the theory has not changed because, you know, P minus P equals 0. And yet the charge current has decayed from 2 eV to 0. Okay. So those sorts of processes give me a finite conductivity, and that's called sigma q. Now, in contrast, this second term is really the Drude peak in disguise. Okay, so if I wanted to compare this to ordinary textbook solid-state physics, I would say that the charge density is some number density times an electric charge. This enthalpy is a number density times a rest mass, and I would get your ordinary Drude formula. Okay, but this time, I've derived the Drude formula for a manifestly relativistic, strongly interacting system. Okay. More generally, the key to get the Drude peak is simply the strong interactions and the weak relaxation of momentum. But importantly, it does not depend on the interactions being weak. Okay. So the interactions can be strong. As long as this momentum relaxing process is slow, however, we still recover this simple Drude peak. Okay. So this was work done by Subir and friends, Sean, and as well as Sean, who's also here, in 2007. Let me mention that, you know, this formula is qualitatively okay. I will shortly tell you, though, that quantitatively it doesn't give us what we want. Okay? So we'll need to soup up this model a little bit to really understand the experiment. But before we soup up the model, let's return to our friend the Wiedemann-Franz law and just see what we would predict for graphene. So let me just tell you that the result is that the ratio kappa over sigma t is the square of a Lorentzian function. And don't worry about what either of those constant coefficients are. The key point is that if you plot this Lorentz ratio over the Wiedemann-Franz prediction, if you had a Fermi liquid, you would just get a constant, okay? And we'd actually know what this constant is. It's 1 in this case. But in hydro, it's nothing like 1. There's no special point where it has to equal 1. And you get this very sharply peaked function, okay? So what's happening here is that, you know, right at this charge neutrality point, if I go back to this equation, you see that J is sigma Q, but the energy density, or the moment, or sorry, the energy current is the momentum density, which is tied to the velocity, okay? So the charge conductivity is strictly finite, it's just sigma Q, but the energy current, or the heat current, which are the same in this special limit, is also only limited by momentum relaxation because a very similar argument holds for the heat current in a temperature gradient, okay, to this boost argument. And so at this point, kappa is only limited by momentum relaxation, but sigma is strictly finite. And so you get just a finite, a very large but finite Lorentz ratio. Out in these wings, what's happening is that the charge and heat currents are almost identical, up to a prefactor, up to a thermodynamic factor. The only thing which separates them is this sort of small sigma Q effect relative to the huge velocities that are only limited by momentum relaxation. Okay. And so in principle, you can also measure a very tiny Lorentz number away from the charge neutrality point. Okay, so that's what we sort of expect. But now we need to soup up our model a little bit to really understand every feature of our data. And the way that we're going to soup up the model is by going back to the experimental data, or not our new experimental data, sorry, but by going back to some older experiments which show the nature of disorder in clean graphene. And what they showed is that the disorder is governed by really big charge puddles where the local value of the chemical potential is changing from point to point, but it's doing so on a pretty long length scale. Okay. In particular, the charge puddles can be 100 nanometers across, so this distance is 100 nanometers, or even possibly larger. And the mean free path of the Dirac fluid at reasonable temperatures would also be comparable to 100 nanometers. So for this cartoon, let me just imagine that this C got up to, you know, a micron, and so, you know, I'll just stretch them out a little bit and hope for the best, you know, in the experimental limit. But the nice thing is that if the disorder was really long wavelength, then by the same argument I gave earlier, all the microscopic dynamics is washed out in regions where this fluid looks homogeneous. Okay. And I know that transport is sensitive to momentum relaxation. So I conclude that the only degrees of freedom which should really contribute to transport are the hydrodynamic degrees of freedom. All the microscopic physics is going to go into, you know, the pressure and the viscosity and the precise values of hydrodynamic coefficients. But I can get the transport coefficients, you know, as a function of things like viscosity by simply solving classical differential equations.
So what is the exact experimental statement about the size of these puddles? I mean, are they just image?
Yes, you just image them with, I think.
Are there also small puddles? So if you like take the Fourier transform of, like, you know,
I don't know if anyone did the Fourier transform, but I can show you. I recently deleted this slide because KC had a very similar one. But you can image them, and basically all of the puddles are about 10 nanometers in a crappy sample, so, you know, what was used in 2006. And about all of them are 1 to 200 nanometers in the boron nitride substrated one. It's not any fractal pattern or anything weird.
It's not a distribution of sizes? It's really just peaked
around? Yeah, it's... Actually, I think one paper might have done the Fourier transform, and it's pretty sharply peaked. But, yeah. So I think, maybe they measured the amplitude of the charge puddles, and that was not heavy-tailed. I don't remember exactly, but it's not weird. I think this is a very plausible assumption. Okay. So more precisely, we're going to consider a fluid that's been placed in a static, inhomogeneous chemical potential background. Okay. Again, this is experimentally motivated because, you know, what's really causing the disorder are charged impurities in the boron nitride substrates in our experiment. Okay. So these charged impurities, you know, cause some local chemical potential fluctuations. They'll get renormalized since, you know, other electrons will try to screen them, but it's not perfect. And we can get transport by linearizing the hydrodynamic equations, solving them when they're sourced with temperature gradients and electric fields, and then computing the spatially averaged charge and heat current. Okay, it's a very simple process. Now, it's hard to do a lot of this analytically, though I really do want to stress that this is completely non-perturbative in the amplitude of disorder. It's, of course, perturbative in this ratio L over C, but having something non-perturbative in disorder amplitudes is still quite powerful. And
what is the amplitude?
How big? The amplitude for graphene is on the order of 30 Kelvin for these charge puddles. So that's why you have to heat it up to, you know, 30 to 40 Kelvin to see this physics. It all fits within the data. Okay. So the first thing which I'll tell you about this formalism is that it can be solved perturbatively analytically. And you recover just the Drude formula. You can get the AC part 2. I haven't shown it, though. But now you get a specific formula for this 1 over tau. And it's a bit messy. It scales like delta mu naught squared times a bunch of dissipative stuff coming from hydro. Okay. And in particular, it depends on both the viscosity and this parameter sigma q. Okay. So the idea, these ideas were developed in this set of papers last year, though I should mention that Steve Kivelson and friends did some similar stuff in Fermi liquids a couple years earlier. Okay, so now to compare to this experimental data, what we're going to do is write down these equations, but then just make a guess for the thermodynamics of this Dirac fluid. You know, people computed these things with weakly interacting kinetic theory, but you know, that's not necessarily reliable for the value of alpha we're looking at. So for us, we just said these are all free parameters. And now we just have to numerically solve these linearized equations. And I just want to emphasize that these are very different from the Navier-Stokes equations that, you know, Leonid and others wrote down previously. In particular, the charge current has this kind of nasty bit related to sigma q. Okay, and it's really important that you include this near the charge neutrality point. Okay, so here's what you get at the end of the day. So in this top row of graphs, what you're looking at is the density dependence of the electrical and thermal conductivity at 75 Kelvin. Now, out where you see gold, the Wiedemann-Franz law is effectively recovered, and so just ignore that part. Okay, that's not where the hydrodynamic theory will hold. If you look at the white region near charge neutrality, you can compare the red experimental data to our purple mean field fit. And what you see is that if you exhaust your fit parameters on the thermal conductivity, you completely overestimate the electrical conductivity. Okay. Whereas there are parameters for the hydrodynamic model which don't get, you know, right on the nose, but do a reasonable job of getting the electrical conductivity as well.
Why
yes.
Do you think it doesn't do better?
Why do I think it doesn't do better? I mean, this model is probably just in the hydrodynamic limit, so there may be non-hydrodynamic effects or higher order terms in the equations of state that we've neglected. I mean, there are many possible reasons.
But the puddles seem to be safe, right? I mean, you said the side they are quite big.
Well, they might be a factor of two bigger than the mean free path, but is that long enough to just completely ignore all non-hydro effects? I mean, we don't know. This is a toy model, you know. But anyway, so there are two reasons why we do better than the purple curve, which I do want to mention. And the first is that we've included the effects of viscous corrections. And so that tends to generally lower the conductivity. And secondly, this numerical simulation to get these blue curves is not a perturbative result. Okay, and so we're able to really account for the fact that delta mu over t is of order 1/2. Okay.
How many parameters are in these bits? Like, is it more in the?
Yeah. So I think there are. I think it's it's about 5. I don't remember the exact number to get these two curves. And then once, so I wouldn't take any of the specific values too seriously. The point is just that there are regimes in hydrodynamics that are consistent with what we're seeing. The other thing is I would say that this axis, it's not clear, is completely right. There's some subtlety there as well.
I just think you're comparing to the mean field approach.
The mean field approach, I think, has 3 fit parameters. So there's it's either 2 or 3 more for the blue curves. But
quite a little
better. Yes. Now the other thing which I want to say though is that now that I really did do it this way. I had fixed these curves and then went and looked at the temperature dependence at the charge neutrality point. So now with no new fit parameters, I'm able to fit in particular the temperature dependence of kappa pretty well. And I think that's a sign that we're really on the right track. the mean field approach also does not have anything to say about this, because this is all captured in tau of t, which we can't determine. Okay, so in that sense, it's not necessarily so bad that we have more fit parameters, because we also have more data that we're forced to fit to. So at the end of the day, I think that, there's certainly a lot to understand about this data. We'd also like to collect cleaner data in the future, where maybe we can actually get a decent fit with the mean field results. Just because they're so clean, and tau won't vary appreciably within this window where kappa is large. I think, do you want to say something, Jeff? Oh, I was just gonna say, but I think we're certainly on the right track, and I think it's encouraging that we get so many qualitative features spot on.
Could you explain again just what you're doing differently than the Drew model?
Okay, so the Drew model, it has an analytic result. It only has a couple fit parameters. Here, what we're basically doing is allowing the system to be inhomogeneous and perhaps very strongly inhomogeneous. So the current need not flow uniformly through the system. It could get bottlenecked, and it can essentially have very complicated behavior. So there need not be a Drude peak, for example.
You're choosing some realization.
Yeah. You simulate. I mean, these curves are basically. We would simulate many times for different random realizations of this chemical potential profile. We'd really solve the inhomogeneous differential equations and just plot the conductivities. And so these curves are averaged over probably 100 disorder realizations with probably 10% fluctuations between different realizations.
So the fit parameters occur in your choice ensemble of disorder realizations?
No, they're things like what's the heat, like these coefficients in thermodynamics. I think we use simple plane waves for the disorder, but if you look at experimentally the amplitude distribution of these charge puddles, I think it's been argued to be approximately Gaussian. So it's not anything crazy that would have heavy tails where you'd expect you need some really wacky charge distribution. We did actually try it, and it doesn't look too much different. It certainly doesn't help at all. Any other questions on the graphene part of the story?
Yeah, just to make sure I understand. So you use the density plot for kappa to fix the parameters?
And sigma. So together we fix the parameters using this top line, and then we just compare to data in the bottom line.
And for the sigma, that's the best we can beat.
Okay, I mean, it's a large enough parameter space that I didn't do some exhaustive statistical search, but this is, I think, it's hard to find something obviously better than this. Like I said, I wouldn't take this too seriously. I mean, it's possible that you really need the full equation of state just because delta mu over t is so big. I think that we're within a factor of 2 is improvement enough.
Okay.
So the small delta mu expansion, is there a corresponding expression for thermal conductivity?
Actually, no. It works surprisingly well to use the naive one, but just with this formula of tau. But in principle, that need not happen. Kappa would generally be of order delta mu to the zero, right? So sigma is order 1 over delta mu squared. And there's a whole hideous mess of corrections at order delta mu to the zero in the conductivity. OK. So in the last third of my talk, I would like to discuss the generalization of some parts of that story to Weyl semimetals. So these will be materials where, similar to graphene, the band structure will be such that there are points in the Brillouin zone where the low energy effective description is given at band theory level by a Weyl Hamiltonian. Okay. Now, unlike for the Dirac Hamiltonian, here it's going to be important that we keep track of this plus or minus sign out in front, because this will tell us whether the fermion is left or right-handed, and they are not equivalent in 3 plus 1 dimensions. For the condensed matter people, you can think of there being a Berry flux of k equals plus or minus 1 associated with these with the q equals 0 point in the Brillouin zone. Okay. Now, that's an important thing to note, because from this perspective, the following theorem doesn't seem so bad. There's a theorem by Nielsen and Ninomiya which states that the net Berry flux must vanish if any lattice produces the band structure that, you know, locally has one of these Weyl points. And how you can see this is that you can imagine integrating the Berry flux over the surface of the Brillouin zone. But the Brillouin zone is a compact space, so that surface is zero. And so you have to get an integral of zero over the net Fermi surface, or over the net Brillouin zone. So as a consequence, if you put one Weyl node with, say, k equals plus 1 somewhere, you have to have a corresponding node of k equals minus 1 somewhere else. Now, it need not have the same property. I mean, there's no symmetry which says that it must have the exact same Fermi velocity or tilt or anything as this one, but it has to be there somewhere. Okay. Now, this has very important consequences for transport. And the way to see this is to consider applying a magnetic field to a single free Weyl fermion. Okay? So like with an ordinary fermion with h equals p squared over 2m, when you apply a magnetic field to a Weyl fermion, you change the band structure quite dramatically, and you get these Landau levels. Okay? So there's going to be the momentum in the direction of the magnetic field will remain a good quantum number. And so you'll get basically a bunch of 1D fermions in some B-dependent dispersion relations. Now, for the Weyl fermion, you get a bunch of filled bands, and then this sort of exactly linear band. And we're going to focus on the physics of this linear band, okay, which will be the most relevant. So it's sort of half-filled, if you like, if we put this system right at charge neutrality. Now, when I apply an electric field, what will happen is that, you know, I've shown a discrete picture here, but you should keep in mind that this is, of course, a continuous process. But when I apply an electric field, you know, my most excited electron will get bumped into the next state, and then the second most excited electron will get bumped into the now empty state, and this process will continue on and on and on. But we're in the continuum, so there's no lowest energy electron in this band. Okay, so if we measure, you know, from here to here, how many new electrons do we have? The answer is, relative to any sensible reference, we have one new electron in the system. So this tells us that at the quantum mechanical level, our classical charge conservation symmetry no longer is true. Okay, so this is called an electromagnetic anomaly for this system. Quantum effects break a classical conservation law. And this has an effect in classical hydrodynamics. I mean, of course, in classical hydrodynamics, the conservation law for the current really comes by just taking the ensemble average of d mu, j mu. So if d mu, j mu is not zero at the quantum level, that will persist to the classical level. And in particular, we find this pretty simple expression for the non-conservation of charge. In a sort of reasonable rest frame for the fluid, the non-conservation of charge is given by E dot B, which should make sense because if I had applied the electric field not in the Z direction, you know, it wouldn't have allowed me to hop these electrons in this zeroth lambda level. And for a while, fermion, this coefficient C is going to be k over 4 pi squared, where k is plus or minus 1, depending on that overall sign sitting out in front of the Hamiltonian. OK, so what does this do to transport? Well, it's easy to see that, you know, what I did before was I applied an electric field and a temperature gradient to the hydro equations, and then I looked for a static solution to the linearized equations perturbed by those sources. But that can't happen for a single Weyl fermion, because I should, you know, if I wanted to impose periodic boundary conditions, which is sensible for thinking about transport coefficients, then I could integrate dijI over the entire space and get zero. But by the conservation law for charge, that's also equal to the integral of C E dot B. But if I apply a constant electric field and a constant magnetic field, then I just get zero. I don't get zero on this side, and so this equation is not true. So what really happens is that, you know, on the lattice, I can't think about necessarily this conservation law for a single Weyl fermion. But then you realize, oh, if I just add up the charge currents for all of my Weyl fermions, this Nielsen-Ninomiya theorem says that this net charge does indeed stay conserved. Okay, so now the picture that you should have in mind is that I turn on my E and B fields and say this red node starts, you know, spontaneously getting fermions, and this orange node is spontaneously depleted, but while maintaining global conservation. Now, unfortunately, that's still not good enough for transport because this doesn't really seem like a static process, right? You know, the red one is growing and the orange one is shrinking. There has to be some sort of balancing effect to get a DC conductivity. And so perhaps, unfortunately, that balancing effect really has to be some UV physics, okay? So to get a finite conductivity, we have to have a mechanism by which this electron can get scattered over here, okay? And only when that process exists will we reach an equilibrium when, you know, the pumping rate equals this scattering rate. Okay. So that's the story for the charge conductivity. But what happens now for the thermal conductivity? So it turns out that there's a very similar equation for the thermal conductivity, or for the heat current, sorry. So if you look at a single chiral fermion, and sorry, for the remainder of this talk, this little A index will denote sort of which Weyl node I'm thinking about. So I have, you know, M Weyl nodes labeled by A, and I'm thinking about how much heat is generated at Weyl node A. So the answer is that there's a number G such that the divergence of the heat current is proportional to grad T dot V. So you might ask, okay, what is this number G? And at least to me, the answer is extremely weird. G is something called an axial gravitational anomaly. And I'm going to use the word axial here instead of electromagnetic just to emphasize that the net anomaly for the electric charge vanishes. What happens is that it's sort of a relative charge between the nodes that becomes anomalous. So presumably to the particle physics people here, that terminology makes sense. But okay, in any case, this G comes about from the following process. Imagine that you take your chiral fluid and you put it on a curved manifold. Okay, so this isn't just, you know, applying a temperature gradient by adding a delta GTX. You really have to put your theory on a genuinely curved manifold. But if you do that, then you will find that there's, again, spontaneous charge generation, and it's proportional to the curvature squared in this peculiar combination. Okay. Now, this is really weird because there really is no gravity in thermal transport, okay? Even if you think about thermal gradients as related to metric perturbations, those metric perturbations have no curvature associated with them, okay? What's happening here is much more subtle, and it was pointed out in a beautiful paper that I don't understand very well. But as far as I can tell, the basic point is that if you imagine taking the plane and just putting a little conical defect in the plane, right? So cut out an angular wedge and glue it back together. Then there's a curvature anomaly, and you can really get something non-zero over here. Now, if you try to remove that curvature defect by sort of, you know, making the conical defect angle shrink to zero, you find a discontinuity if this charge current is not appropriately modified to have a non-zero coefficient proportional to G. Okay. So G doesn't depend on this angular deficit, right? It's a property of the field theory. And so even on flat space, J will be corrected by this anomaly G, even on flat space. Okay. And so that's how this equation can hold, although I admit that it's quite weird. So what do you have to do to the charge current for hydro to make sense? So there are two terms that you have to add. So I showed you the non-chiral pieces. You've got an NV plus sigma Q times a bunch of stuff. And to that, you have to add two terms. The first one in the rest frame of the fluid is proportional to the vorticity. And it has some kind of ugly coefficient, but we know it exactly. It's related to the anomalies times thermodynamic stuff. And there's another coefficient proportional to the magnetic field with a similar, you know, thermodynamic stuff times anomaly coefficients. And so what we're now going to do, and the stress tensor, by the way, picks up no changes. So what we're now going to do is think of a theory of transport where it's very similar to before. We're going to source the system with electric fields and temperature gradients. But now we're going to sort of ad hoc add some terms to the right-hand side of our conservation laws in a kind of funny way. Okay. So firstly, we're going to, okay, so what we're basically going to do is say that in the rest frame of the fluid, if there's a charge imbalance between either fluid, but let's say between two Weyl nodes, or a temperature imbalance, so any kind of imbalance in thermodynamic parameters will lead to some exchange of charge in general. Okay, but we're going to demand that for all the charge that node A loses, you know, node B gains that charge. Okay, so we have a global conservation of charge between all the nodes, and that will be enforced by these kinds of equations. And we're similarly going to allow this process for energy. Okay. And okay, I've written it in a kind of weird form, but this turns out to be very convenient for the calculation. The key point is that we're trying to write down the most general possible thing consistent with this idea that the valley fluids can exchange energy and charge, but we're going to do so in what ends up being a Lorentz covariant way. Okay. I haven't written it that way, but we did in our paper. Now, you can imagine saying, okay, I should have some second law of thermodynamics if I'm doing hydrodynamics, right? This is how we say things like the viscosity is positive. So let's check what happens to the second law of thermodynamics when we've got this intervalley scattering. What you find is that if you want a local entropy current, the only thing you could write down at leading order would be this SAU mu A. And what you find is that it actually has a non-zero divergence even at the ideal fluid level once you have this intervalley scattering. Okay. So in some sense, you know, this R breaks the naive gradient expansion unless you think of these Rs as, you know, coming in a sort of weird order. But in any case, what you find, but ignoring those sorts of subtle issues, you find that there's entropy production even at the ideal fluid level. And so this is going to impose a positive definite constraint on this matrix of intervalley scattering coefficients. Okay. So we thought about this, and I mean, I wouldn't say it's completely rigorous, but I can't think of any local contribution that you could add to this which would be able to cancel a term like this. If anything, I think you'd just make the situation worse. So. Just because, you know, there's nothing local you could write down whose derivative is going to be, whose derivatives will be the zeroth order. But yes, I agree that this isn't 100% rigorous, though I think it's reasonable.
And you mean local on the scale of the correlation?
Local on the mean free path. Yeah. So, I should note that these dissipative RABs, you know, this isn't completely ad hoc. We do actually have a microscopic way to compute them in terms of the spectral weight of essentially dt of the charge density at each while node. So there might be some subtlety in regulating these operators, but you know, presumably you can do this reasonably. And then in addition to these RABs, similar formulas give you a completely microscopic way of computing every hydrodynamic coefficient for any microscopic Hamiltonian. Okay, so this formalism can really be applied to your pet theory, though I admit it may be very, very difficult to compute this object without some large n limit. Okay, so we put all of this together and we repeat the process that we did for graphene in a kind of funky perturbative limit where we're going to take the magnetic field B, the disorder strength, and these dissipative coefficients R to all be perturbatively small in just the right way that essentially every effect contributes at the same order, at leading order. You could take a less constrained perturbative limit, but then you just ignore some terms, depending on what limit you took. So the conductivity we find looks like this. So I'm not sure if that's super enlightening to people right away, but hopefully this form is a little bit more enlightening. So the conductivity is a sum of a Drude contribution for each while node. They're completely independent of one another. That's just the sum over A. Okay, so it's as if we had a bunch of conductivities that add in parallel, and then we get an anomalous contribution aligned in, when both indices are aligned with the magnetic field. Okay, and the coefficient of this anomalous piece depends on this intervalley scattering, and it couples all the valley fluids together in this way. Now, you know, similar results have been found in the past, but I think this certainly generalizes all of them, certainly to the non-quasiparticle limit. And I'll talk a little bit more about why the particular structure of that form is interesting in two slides. But let me now mention that more generally, we find a very similar structure for the thermoelectric transport coefficients.
So this bit, back again for a second, so there's a gamma squared. So what was gamma again?
Oh, sorry. So gamma is basically epsilon plus p over tau.
So that has a lifetime limit, right?
Well, if you set b equals zero, this becomes, you know, like this becomes this.
It's just this.
It's the cyclotron pole.
Yeah, so if gamma goes, just free association, but you know, there are these observations in the neckties where there's t squared plus b squared. Is this t squared plus, so if gamma was like t?
T squared plus B squared?
Oh, okay.
I mean, I don't think there's anything too deep here. This is the same sort of Drude peak that would show up with quasiparticle physics. So, yeah, this isn't a surprising result.
Okay, so it's generic that if gamma goes like T, that it's T squared plus B squared?
Yes. Well, if N is temperature independent. But though then, of course, you have these extra factors of T on top. And,
sure.
But yeah. Okay. So you get a similar formula for alpha and kappa bar. But the key point which I want to emphasize is that if you look at the anomalous contributions, they have the same form, but both of these coefficients explicitly depend on this axial gravitational coefficient. Okay. So if there were no axial gravitational anomalies in the real world, you would not measure any anomalous contributions to thermal transport. Okay. And why did I go through the song and dance with the second law? Well, now we can prove that our conductivity matrix is Onsager reciprocal and positive definite. Okay, so that's nice because if you do this in a, you know, just you just write something down and go, you do not recover this property. Okay, so it's actually important that we, you know, do the computation in this precise way to recover a positive definite conductivity matrix. And I think the punchline which I'd like to get across is that, again, thermoelectric transport only has this anomalous contribution if this novel anomaly exists. Okay, it does exist for a while for a free while fermion. G would be 1/24th up to a sign, but it's never actually been observed in the lab as far as I can tell. Okay. All right, so now we get to why I'm excited by this result. Because negative magnetoresistance in sigma, if you like the angle-dependent b squared contribution to the conductivity, in the past year, this has been measured about 10 times. I picked this paper because this is the nicest plot that I could find. But okay, basically what they're doing here is when this angle phi equals 0, so that's this bottom curve, this is E aligned with B, okay? So then you see that the resistance, not the conductivity, but anyway, the resistance decays as you increase B squared. Alternatively, the conductivity is going to be approximately quadratic. But if you make E parallel, or sorry, perpendicular to B, then the resistivity is always increasing, or the conductivity is always decreasing. So this tells you that there's significant angular dependence in the conductivity, and this is associated with, in all likelihood, these sorts of anomalous effects. Okay. You know, we don't have some independent check as far as I know, but I think it's very plausible that this angular dependence in sigma of B is telling you that, that it's a consequence of the anomaly. So now the point I would like to make is that if you buy...
This measurement most probably in the quasi-particle regime.
Yes, hold, I'm getting there, hold on.
Okay.
So this, if you believe this measurement, which many people do, this paper was in Science, there's many others in flashy journals, this measurement, if you measure the same effect in either alpha or kappa bar, then it is the first observation of a gravitational anomaly in the real world, as far as I know. So I think that's another flashy headline for any of the experimentalists here. Okay, so now let me just briefly talk about beyond the hydro regime. So, okay, first the Wiedemann-Franz law is gone in the hydro regime. That's not a surprise. But you could also imagine doing this experiment when mu is much bigger than T. And in general, you don't really have a choice. You're just given a Weyl material. It just has some Fermi energy. But you can still use our formalism, even in Fermi liquids, if the intervalley scattering time is really, really long compared to mu over T squared. Okay, and so we're able to compute the anomalous contribution to the Wiedemann-Franz law. And basically, the deviations at smaller temperature, or sorry, larger temperature, have the wrong sign relative to what you would expect for the non-anomalous contribution. And similarly, the anomalous Mott law for alpha has the opposite sign as the non-anomalous piece. So I'll just tell you that if you go through our formalism and use kinetic theory to compute these intervalley scattering coefficients, this timescale limit gives you these weird sign changes. OK, so since I'm a little bit over time, let me just leave up my conclusions and take any questions. Thank you.
So on your last experimental plot, is it possible to actually measure the anomaly coefficients?
No, because you don't know. So if you look at this formula, for example, you've got all of this crap sitting here that you don't know. So if that's the short answer.
The measurement of electrical, you probably want to show one side only of sigma.
Oh, yes. Sure, but it looks similar for all of them. People have estimated it, but I think they assume the value for C, and then they estimate. They'll say R is like 1 over tau and just estimate tau, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, so I was trying to establish a connection with the usual Neil semi-classical approach based on the Bethe curvature. Since this single Weyl node would carry a Bethe curvature,
right,
you can expect these side jump and skew scattering contributions.
Right.
So is there a way of incorporating?
Yeah, so we've done. So I would say we've done the comparison with kinetic theory in the appendix of our paper. There's one subtlety, which is that typically in kinetic theory, you assume that the electron-electron scattering time is slower than the intervalley scattering time. That's, I think, an assumption made in every, the Sun-Spivak paper, the Spivak-Andreev paper. They all make this assumption. And it actually gives us a slightly different result for mu large compared to T, but not too large. So when I showed you this plot, they would predict something different in their formalism. And it's a matter of which order of limits you take. I think you can certainly compare with this, up to this subtlety.
Yeah.
So you're saying that if the intervalley scattering time is very long,
yes,
then you're going to measure a conductivity which is much higher than you expect, or not?
Yes, then it's the anomalous contribution will grow. Basically, I mean, for example, if these coefficients were exponentially suppressed because you needed some some photon to carry you all the way over, then yeah, I mean, as you lower the temperature, for example, which you'll exponentially suppress this process, and these coefficients will become huge. Or sorry, they'll become very tiny, and their inverse will become huge. I don't know I don't think in the lab the effect is quite that dramatic, but in principle, you might expect it.
How long
can
people measure that discovery time?
How large?
How well can people measure
that? Oh. Probably depends on who you ask, but I'm not the best person to ask. I know there was a recent paper that said that this is all bullshit, but I think that most people think that it's at least qualitatively right. They argued basically what happens is that these are all edge effects, and that if you slightly misalign the current, you get weird edge contributions that explain all of this. But I don't think that's a popular opinion, though I haven't talked to these people that much, so I don't know for sure. How? I mean, I think they basically do just a standard resistance measurement on a slab that's rotated, or probably they have some magnetic fields and rotate their sample or rotate the B fields around the fix.
But how do you know which nodes are compared?
Which node? I mean, you just measure the conductivity and.
So this question was, can you measure the intervalley scattering time?
Oh, directly?
Yes.
That, I think, is very hard. You'd probably have to make assumptions about these numbers. Though in principle, for example, if you measured the thermal conductivity, and you assume G is 1 over 24 because you almost have a free Weyl fermion, then you could get one of these inverse coefficients. One other thing to keep in mind, though, is that I think one of the popular choices of these semi-metals has 24 Weyl nodes. So you're inverting a big-ass matrix, and you probably can't extract any coefficient reliably. So there's also that.
Some of the data you can see, they try to fit the chemical potential, because when they grow the crystal, the chemical potential just come up a number. So it's difficult to tell.
Which paper is it that says that this is all bullshit?
It came out a couple months ago. I don't remember exactly, but yeah, it was just
on the archive.
It was on the archive, yes. So, I mean, I skimmed through it. Like I said, they claim that it's that if you misalign the current, you can generate some.
No, I'm asking because whether it's the paper of the people I know, but what they can.
Okay.
What they can certainly show, because I listen to this a lot. What they can certainly show is that it's really easy to measure in a very high mobility material. It's really easy to measure a negative longitudinal Vigito resistance in a material that shouldn't have an axial anomaly due to an experimental artifact. That doesn't mean that every experiment on every interesting material is wrong, mm-hmm. but it means that you've got to really ask tough questions of the experimental group. So it's
okay.
Really just sort of a totally non-exotic systematic error experiment.
Yeah.
Can lead to a bad result.
That's completely fair. I just want to clarify that maybe if one of these people were here, they would be.
Oh, I mean,
they'd defend their experiment vigorously.
That's from Ang's group, right?
Yes.
And they have gone on to a much more rigorous geometry. That geometry there is, you've got to really worry about alignment, but they've gone on to a more rigorous one and got the same thing. That's
okay.
Why I'm carefully saying it doesn't mean that everything's wrong. But of the 10 claims that you see,
okay.
Certainly some portion of them will be right, yeah.
Okay, fair enough. As long as one of them is right, then I'm still happy. Okay. Yeah.
I have a graphing calculation.
Sure.
Is it possible that there's some effective improvement of the Navier-Stokes equation which incorporates the averaging of the choice?
That is something I've thought about doing, but I haven't made any systematic progress on it.
Okay, thank you again.